The Chicago Symphony Orchestra has been on strike for 5 weeks. On Monday, musicians rejected an offer management called their last, best, and final one. Plus, writer and comedian Julia Sweeney returns to the 21st to talk about her latest role as a mom in the new Hulu series, Shrill. And Illinois could legalize recreational marijuana this year, but there's already a whole world of edibles that includes Illinois chefs, writers, and manufacturers.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
All that and more coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, the Chicago Symphony Orchestra has been on strike for 5 weeks. They just canceled a concert, actually, planned in central Illinois for next week. Today, we're going to speak to some of the musicians about what they're hoping for in contract negotiations. And actor, writer, and comedian Julia Sweeney joins us to talk about her role in the new Hulu series, Shrill. But first, we've been hearing a lot about the legalization of marijuana here in Illinois, what that will mean for our criminal justice system and for our economy. But with marijuana already legal in many states and medical marijuana legal here in Illinois and many other places, the question is often not if you can use it, but how. And for many people, the answer to that question is eating it. Edible marijuana has come a long way from brownies and cookies. There's a whole industry of gourmet cooks and manufacturers dedicated to making restaurant-quality food that, yes, also happens to be dosed with cannabis. Joining me now are two people in Illinois at the center of this movement. Mindy Siegel is a James Beard Award-winning pastry chef and owner of Hot Chocolate in Chicago. She's also the creator of Mindy's Edibles. Jolene Rivera is the founder of Kitchen Toke. That's a national magazine based in Chicago that's devoted to cooking with cannabis. Mindy, Jolene, welcome to the 21st. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning. Hi, Jolene.
So you guys are saying hi to each other as well. Mindy, so you're a veteran chef. Hot Chocolate's been open for almost 15 years now. What made you want to start in the edible business?
I don't know. I guess I've always been sort of like a renegade chef, and I was approached by multiple people when the law was going to be passed for medical usage in Illinois, and the more I started doing research on it and thinking about it and reading about it, I felt like it was the right thing to do for me. So I sort of felt like it was an extension of what I do now. It's just providing sort of a product for people and giving them what they want or what they need. So felt good about it, and I still do.
Do you use the term cannabis, or do you use medical marijuana, or both?
I use edibles, you know.
So you just stick with edibles. Okay.
I do. I'm trying to figure out the right answer for that. But yeah, no, I mean, whatever comes in my mind, I guess.
Jolene, what made you want to start a food magazine about cooking with cannabis?
Well, I hadn't really been a cannabis user. I mean, we all have our stories where we tried it in high school, right? But I hadn't really done it since then. And my friend, a really good friend of mine and coworker, Nellie Williams, her dad got sick with cancer in 2011, and he was having a hard time eating, sleeping without pain. So I, wired one of my friends and said, hey, can you get me some infused edibles, and drove them down to Missouri and gave them to him and watched them, work for him. He had three of those right one after another. I asked him to wait and kind of slow down, but
that's frightening.
To him, though, he was in so much pain, what could it hurt? He was having a hard time just swallowing whole foods. So he ate three chocolates in about 30, 40 minutes. You could see that the pain was subsiding. He was jovial. He was happy. He was playing with his grandkids. He went for a walk around the block, and it was just something his family hadn't seen in a while. And that's when I had been in the magazine publishing food industry for 20 years. So it was just sort of when you put that together, when you see that, you know that you can produce a magazine that might really help people. So it was an obvious equation to me to figure out and say, how can we help people cook with cannabis, really? So that, you know, not everyone wants to smoke it. And to me, you know, I'm a runner and I don't drink and I'm a health advocate. So I just thought I could elevate my own health and help other people do the same.
And so this is based in Chicago. What kind of interest have you gotten across the country for the magazine, Jolene?
Well, we're in 2,500 stores in the United States and Canada. We're also in Spain, New Zealand, Australia, the UK, Germany, and did I say the Netherlands? I probably did. But so we just went there. We went overseas in December. But we are, you know, we're covered. We're carried in stores from Walmart to the Modern Museum of Art in New York. So it's funny. I was just saying the other day, the breadth of audience that you get. You know, I have 21-year-old hip hop artists asking us to do events for them, and then I have, you know, 72-year-old you know, grandparents looking to elevate their wellness. So the audience, you know, the vast majority of people, I've never produced a product that has this range before. So it's really interesting.
Yeah, it sounds like a huge market. A huge market too, right, Jolene? Did you expect that you would have such widespread interest when you started Kitchen Toke?
I hope so. I mean, you never really know, you know. I mean, a lot of people are afraid of it, but they're so interested. And, you know, for anyone who's looking at an entry point in getting into the cannabis space, there's really nowhere to go. I love High Times Cannabis Now and Dope Magazine, but those don't really speak to me. They're not really mainstream magazines. Unless you already know a lot about cannabis, you know, those magazines are for you. But I wanted to create a magazine that spoke to my aunt, my grandmother, you know, someone else, my best friend's mother, you know, a little bit more mainstream and a little more approachable, a little more friendly, not, you know, you're not going to open up a page and say, read about OG Kush, you know. So it's a little less intimidating. And I always tell people, if you really want to start, this is a really good entry point.
And Minty, for you, I wonder, people know you for your pastries, for your cookbook about cookies. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the edibles that you are creating now?
So we have two separate lines. We have Mindy's Kitchen, which is a much more of a beginner's approach to a less expensive line, and then we have Mindy's Edibles, Artisan Edibles, which is the higher end, which is what we started with. And it's made with clear distillate, which is tasteless and odorless, and it's much more of a high-end brand. And how we started out with chocolate brittles, and the reason why we started out with chocolate brittles is because I've been making brittles for years, and they're sort of like my favorite way to eat chocolate. And I wanted to do something that I make in my restaurant that maybe people have had before, and with just adding the ingredient of cannabis. So,
And I wonder, how did it change? Like, I mean, when you're thinking about the taste of the brittle that people are used to in the restaurant, in hot chocolate, when you're doing an edible and you're adding a marijuana into it, how did you think about factoring the taste factor and
So we started with clear distillate, which is tasteless and odorless. So you can't taste it. It just tastes like my product that you would get in a restaurant. So that's how we started. And the reason, and it's interesting because, you know, we're in a medical state. So, you know, we have evolved, and that's how we started in Mindy's Kitchen, is that, you know, listening to patient feedback and finding out what people need and what people want. And like Jolene said, there's such a wide range audience. It's everybody, and there's sick people, there's recreational in other states, and there's so many people to touch and to create for. So, you know, we really wanted to create the Mindy's Kitchen line is used with winterized oil, and that has flavor. So we kind of like pair the flavors with the strains that we're using so that they complement each other. And I think that, you know, like my product, both lines are very chef-driven. They're made with taste and quality in mind before anything else. We just use the cannabis as another ingredient to go into the product.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you said that, Mindy. That's a really good point. And yeah. Mindy has given us and contributed to our magazine. So I think, you know, we both align in that way. It is about the taste. And you have chefs who are doing what Mindy is doing. You have chefs who work with the flavor of cannabis, and you have chefs who try to just have beautiful dishes with really good food. And you know the cannabis is in there, and it elevates your experience, but it doesn't get in the way of the flavor.
Right.
Would that be right, Mindy? Yeah.
Yeah. And also, you know, I kind of feel like with my name on a brand, I think people feel comfortable. They feel safer because there's like a face attached to the brand.
Well, and they know your food. They know your cooking.
Right.
They've probably
exactly.
eaten in, you know, they've been to Hot Chocolate. So there's a relationship that's already established with
exactly.
you, right?
And, you know, the baked goods that we sell are the recipe is literally taken from my cookbook. And, you know, so I'm hoping that not only are they good and they're chef-driven, but they're also approachable and they're honest using great ingredients. So, you know.
And Jolene, can I ask you, when you go on Kitchen Toke, it looks like any other beautiful cooking site with beautiful pictures and recipes. And we tend to think about sweets in this category, but you do a lot of savory recipes. I saw a lot of infused vegetables. What are those very popular with readers?
Well, yeah, we just did a vegan story with Chef Lauren Vanderpool, who is the personal chef for Common, Stevie Wonder, Sugar Ray Leonard, and Serena and Venus Williams. So when you think about chefs of that caliber and like Mindy contributing to our magazine, you know, those, you know, working with veggies in that way and having a name and a face behind it, a really good solid recipe like that, it does attract attention. You have the health and wellness arena, I guess, looking at Kitchen Toke for some new ways to self-care, to manage your own health, and to take control of your own health. So if, you know, I'm not going to say that we only do healthy foods, but, you know, I believe that, you know, people try to live, you know, a healthful lifestyle, and then we all deserve a cheat day, which is when we get to have all the good stuff.
Yeah.
Jolene, I wanted to ask you about, for people who are using this medicinally or if they live in states where marijuana is legal, how you can control or predict the effects of edibles, because I think lots of people have bad edible stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well,
I could probably answer that question.
Oh, go ahead, Mindy.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt, but I can probably answer that question.
Go ahead, Mindy.
So dosing is extremely important, and it's also highly regulated. And that's what's great about all the states becoming either medicinally legal or recreational legal, that the states are regulating how much THC or CBD or the combination of the two go into each dose. And so there are guidelines that you have to follow, and you also have to have very rigorous testing. And so by that, if you start out with a jumping gate of a 10 milligram dose, you can take it from there. So 10 milligrams is what is a legal dosage. And for people that have never ingested THC, my suggestion to them is to start off with a quarter of a piece. And this is, again, in a medicinal state. In recreational states, it's very popular to microdose, which is either 2.5 milligram dosage or 5 milligram dosage. And then it's even smaller. So if you start out small, then you can sort of figure out what your body and your body chemistry and how your body can handle the medicine or, you know, whatever it is. And I always feel like that's like a really important thing to talk about, because you know, people look at an edible and they're like, oh, I'm hungry and I'm delicious. It's delicious and I'm going to eat 100 milligrams. And what they don't understand is that 100 milligrams is what gives you those stories that everybody talks about. And you have to be very, very careful.
We usually tell people to start at about 5 milligrams, and we always tell them to start low, go slow. There's nothing that can go wrong, I think, when you start off with microdosing and small amounts. And, you know, whether they're cooking at home or whether buying edibles, we always recommend that people do exactly that.
Jolene, I wonder what you say to people. You've been talking a lot about eating healthy and how that's important to you. I wonder what your counter is to people who might be listening to this thinking, this is in most places still an illegal recreational drug. How can that be healthy?
Well, I think if you look at some of the things that are being discovered and the anecdotal evidence of people who are cooking with cannabis or even just starting with CBD, I think it's... I think it's very prevalent in what's being found or discovered by people in general and the stories that we're telling in Kitchen Talk. We have a lot of stories of people talking about cannabis and how it's just started to help them with inflammation, or people who have anxiety, or people who have a stress to deal with, or PTSD. Or we interviewed Jordan Nixon out of Denver, who figured out a dosage in just CBD only, how to manage his MS. So I think that all of the stories that we hear, we look at the results that people are having, and I don't think that those can be ignored.
That's Jolene Rivera, who's the founder of Kitchen Talk. We will tweet out more information about Kitchen Talk, including links to their site. It's a national magazine, an international magazine, as we've been talking about, based in Chicago. I want to thank Mindy Siegel for being with us as well. She's a James Beard Award-winning chef and owner of Hot Chocolate and the creator of Mindy's Edibles. Ladies, thank you both for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thanks, Mindy.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you've started to do your Mother's Day card shopping early, you've probably seen words like loving, warm, and nurturing. I'm going to guess you haven't seen any terms like nagging, micromanaging, or shrill. That last word really cuts. But it's also the name of a new series on Hulu that's getting lots of acclaim for its humor, its writing, and its performances by actors Julia Sweeney, who, as you guessed it, plays a mom. Here she is in a scene with her daughter in the lead role, played by Adie Bryant.
Mom?
Oh, hi.
Oh, hi.
I didn't know you were coming over.
Yeah.
Oh.
Where's Dad?
Oh, he's laying down.
Hey, are you liking the thin menu?
Because I am loving it.
I don't know. It's fine. I definitely am starving all day long.
Oh, okay. Well, are you doing the almonds between meals? 6 almonds keeps me full for hours.
Yeah, I'm doing the almonds. They're so satisfying. Sometimes when I have 6 almonds, I feel like I had 12 almonds.
Oh, you're joking.
Sorry, it sucks.
You know, this stuff isn't exactly free, Annie. You know, excuse me for trying to do something to help both of us get a little bit healthier.
That's Adie Bryant and my guest, Julia Sweeney, on Hulu's new series, Shrill. Hi, Julia. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hello, I'm so glad to be here.
So I mentioned some of the ways we talk about our mothers, both good and bad. How would you describe your character?
I have to say I have a lot of sympathy for her. yeah, it's funny to hear that scene because I've been getting so much feedback like, oh, she's a nightmare. I go, really? I don't think she's acting that much different than I would probably be acting. I feel like when you're a mom, you're in a no-win situation. And I love the show because I love the message of the show, which is 80s character Annie learning to make herself, her life much better without changing herself, just accepting for herself the way she is. And she struggled a lot with weight. And I'm a mom, and I'm obviously also struggling with weight and concerned about hers and trying to figure out ways to attack it together. And I guess it is undermining. And if I were my mom, I would hate me. But I also feel like, who else would be doing that but the mom?
That's what my mom says. She's like, well, who else could tell you this?
Exactly. Like, and it's so funny because I even say that to my daughter, not about weight, but other things. I'll say like, okay, I have to tell you this. And the reason why I'm telling you it is there's literally no one in your life that will tell you this but me. Like, so, and I can withstand you hating me for telling you this, but you should know this. Like that. And so, yeah, I would describe my mother character as typical and heartfelt and positively trying to help and naive and failing in every way.
When you were on the program last, it was to talk about your Second City show. We talked about how you'd taken a bit of time off to be with your daughter. Have you played many roles as a mom in your professional life?
You know, I did, but of course, obviously, when I was younger, I was the mother to younger children. But yeah, like in the Beethoven movies, and yeah, I seem to have gotten a lot of mom kind of parts, but not for the last, because I really did take off the last 10 years. And now I'm old enough to play the mom of a 30-something.
And I wonder, when we think about that, your daughter's a young adult, right? So perhaps.
Yeah, well, she's 19, yeah.
Okay, so she's maybe a little younger, but around, I would think, the target demographic for many of Shrill's viewers would be like.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Women in the college to 20 something. I wonder, what has she said to you about the program?
She likes it. She likes it, and her friends like it. And, I mean, I think she. She doesn't see me as the villain so much. I think she just sees me as typical, intruding, interfering, ineptly mother.
I think she'd probably be a little more charitable than that, Julie.
Well, and I think she likes the message of the show. Like, and also, like, the 80, who's larger, gets to be the sexy star of this show. And she is sexy, and she is fantastic. And I think that Mulan feels like, well, because we talk about, I mean, Mulan is not a heavy at all, but she's been around me her whole life, obviously. And we talk a lot about the diet culture and the culture that I grew up in, which was that you were good or you're bad. And every day you either were good with food or bad with food. And that in the end, it's probably very unhelpful. You know, like, I don't think for all those years of having that feeling and all the different diets that it really probably made any difference in my weight in the end. It just made me feel, you know, bad about myself, which, of course, there are people who are heavy often are eating as a coping mechanism. So if you're feeling bad about yourself, there's one sure way to feel good. That's by eating. And then it's a bad feedback loop, you know, like.
Right, so, because then you feel bad about what you ate.
Right. And so in the end, like we all look back and think what we might do differently. When it comes to that area, I think if I had just been more loving towards myself and accepting instead of punishing in my mind, I don't think I would be bigger than I am, and I might even be smaller than I am. Mm. And so that in that sense, I think that's one of the greatest things about this show is just kind of showing how self-defeating and self-punishing that kind of mindset is in the people themselves and in the culture.
My guest is Julia Sweeney, and she's the star of one of the stars of the new Hulu series Shrill. And I think, Julia, everyone who's listening to you, I would think of the vast majority of people who are listening right now can relate to what you're talking about, right? With food,
yeah,
and bodies and our identities. And I wanted to play another moment from Shrill, and I was hoping we can talk about it a little bit.
This is nice, Mom.
So peaceful and quiet. You know they found a meth hut over there in the woods a few years ago?
Really?
Yeah. It's okay now. They cleaned it out. They turned it into an information booth.
Meth information, though, right?
No, it's about the park. Oh, I have to remind your father to do his prednisone. Let me just text.
Okay, but he has that alert on his phone, though.
Yeah, but I just need to double check.
Okay, but he's probably got it under control.
Well, then I'd worry that he didn't have it under control, so it's just easier. It's for me. Anyway, it's just for me.
Okay.
Okay. But you know what makes me happy is that we're out here exercising.
Yeah.
You always feel better when you exercise. I can tell. It's easy, Annie. Just put it on the calendar and just stick to it.
All right. Why are you saying that to me? You know, we were having such a nice time, and then you just toss off a little comment like that? How does that make me feel?
Okay, you said it, and I hear you.
Good.
That's a moment from Shrill with Julia.
Oh my God, there's so much going on in that scene.
There's a lot going on there, right, Julia?
Yes.
So I did want to ask you about you and AD and your acting relationship, but because we just played that, I wonder how much you want to react to just, I really appreciate how honest and real I feel like Shrill is in so many ways, and I feel like this is one of them.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's funny because I watch the show, but it goes by so quickly, but listening to it right there, I'm thinking how, well, two things. One is I'm thinking she's being, my character is being inartful. Like, she's got to keep doing the nurturing and the nudging, but she's got to be more artful with how she does it so it isn't so obvious. So it's not that I think she shouldn't be doing that. I just think she needs to be subtler about it.
Yeah, she just kind of needs to hide it a little bit more.
And then the other part of it, I mean, I feel like is a heartbreaking thing, although it's also, like all heartbreaking or many heartbreaking things, is also a wonderful, complicated thing, which is that women, I think, for the most part, some men are like this too, but I'm just, on balance, women are caretakers, and they're the caretaker heart of the family, and they're going to keep everything going. And I think that's both a wonderful thing and a horrible thing. And I feel, even in my own life, trapped by those impulses. And it's hard to figure out the right note of caretaking of others that is helpful and is a true act of love, and then the kind of caretaking that's annoying and ultimately pushing people away because of kind of annoying types of caretaking and nudging. And so, but those are the things I struggle with every day. I struggle about that with my husband and daughter, and every day I have some speech going on in my head one way or the other about backing off something that I'm not going to let affect me, or figuring out why it's good for me to say this thing. And of course, there's no one-size solution fits all, and every situation is unique and is very complicated, and then you're dealing with the moods of everyone involved. But I think that's one of the curses and the wonderful things about women's caretaking nature, is that you're kind of trapped in this constant caretaking and figuring out how to let that play out and how to let it play out. And so when I hear that, I feel empathy for my character.
Well, you feel empathy for her. And the word that kept coming to mind for me is, I think there's, when you said she needs to be more subtle, I was just thinking about the title of this series, which is Shrill. And shrill is not a word that men ever get called, right?
Yes, exactly.
But I wonder, when we think about the characters having their shrill moments on the show, why you think that's such a good title and why you think that's so necessary.
Well, okay, that was a perfect example, that scene. Like, you could see how my character could be accused, as she is in the scene, by Annie, 80's character, of, like, why are you ruining this moment? Why are you pushing that right now? And I don't know if men would either do that, or if they did do that, would be accused of being shrill. They would just be accused of caring too much, or leave me alone about that. It would be, there's something, like, about the word shrill that is nudgy and interfering, and also it's about the tone of voice. It's even about the level of the voice. Like, there's something about when that word that is used that it's so unfair, and it's something that's just never, it's just like how women can be called a bitch. I don't know if you can say that on the show, or when they're being assertive, and men are seen as strong behaving the same way. So, and I feel like it's this chronic unresolvable problem, my new favorite phrase, because I don't know how you solve it. You know, like, it's unfair, but I don't see how it gets solved except for maybe things like this where you stop and discuss about how unbalanced it is, how men and women are perceived when they're doing the same things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I wanted to just switch topics here and ask you just about you and AD. So AD Bryant, sure, is the main character in this. Both, I think people will know her from Saturday Night Live as they know you from Saturday Night Live.
Right.
Is that a blessing or a curse to have to be in
it's
SNL?
So a blessing. It's so a blessing. And, you know, I didn't know, I was a fan of hers, but I hadn't met her until, you know, we got together, I think the first time for the film, like after I got the part even. And you know, I mean, I don't feel motherly towards her in real life in that she needs that kind of mothering thing around her. God, she's the most, like, she was an executive producer and a producer and completely involved in every aspect of the show. And so it's not like we fell into that kind of relationship, but I feel so much affection toward her that I guess it could be in the realm of motherly. And we did get along great. I think we have a really similar sense of humor and a similar sense of cynicism and optimism, like, because everyone has that, but it's in different degrees. And I feel like ours is similar.
So, Julia, I know that as we're thinking about this series, Shrill, there's like there are some very dramatic moments on the show. There's scenes between you and your daughter, that's AD, and your husband. But the set also seemed like it was pretty fun. And I heard that AD took the cast to a strip club. Did you go?
No, I didn't go.
Did you want to go?
I don't think Daniel Stern went either. I think she meant the cast that were her friends in the show, okay, not her parents.
Okay. And this was a really quick run. It was 6 episodes. You're back in Illinois now?
Well, I'm only here for one night. I'm going to Spokane tomorrow morning, but and I'm living in Los Angeles now, so.
Okay.
And we haven't heard if there's a season 2, but I have my fingers crossed.
And what's next for you apart from possibly a season 2 for Shrill?
Well, everything I can't really talk about, but actually I did another pilot that was actually Chicago-based show that kind of came out of Second City that looks like Showtime's buying it for 8 episodes, so I'm waiting to hear about that.
Wow.
Very, very exciting.
Congratulations.
Although it's not for publication yet, but it's just something that's, it's about to be announced, I believe. That's the latest word. And then the show that I developed at Second City last year, I did a run of it at the Geffen Theater in L.A., which was very well received. And then Largo, which is just this fantastic music and comedy place, asked me to do it once a month. And I just did it last week. And the next one I'm going to do is June 17th. But then I'm going to do it once a month for the rest of the year there, which I'm really excited about because some of my most favorite comedians do shows there once a month. And so that's a big feather in my cap.
Yeah. Well, you can stream all of Shrill now on Hulu. And I should mention one of the episodes that's getting a lot of attention was written by Illinois native Samantha Irby. You can find my interview with her as well as my last conversation with Julia at our website, 21stshow.org. Julia, thanks for coming back to talk to us.
Thank you. I'm so happy.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. That's members of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. In a free performance at the Chicago Temple this past Friday, they weren't performing at Symphony Center because they're on strike. Over the past month, there have been two big strikes in the city of Chicago. One was at UIC, where graduate students went on strike over salaries and student fees. That ended this past Friday, but there doesn't seem to be any end in sight for the CSO. Yesterday, the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana announced a performance by CSO musicians scheduled for next week has been canceled. Actually, all performances until April 23rd have been canceled. The musicians have been on strike since March 10th after contract negotiations, which have been going on since the spring of 2018. On Monday, musicians overwhelmingly rejected an offer management described as their, quote, last, best, and final offer. Cynthia Yeh is the principal percussionist for the orchestra. Gina DiBello is a violinist. Both of them are members of CSO's negotiating team and on the line with us now. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Gina, as I mentioned, you all have been on strike since March 10th, but you've been negotiating your contract since well before then. How hard was it to decide to finally go out on strike?
Well, you know, it's always a difficult decision to have a work stoppage, of course, but actually from what has been proposed to us and really the lack of movement from their side, I wouldn't say it was an easy decision, but it was really the only decision we had at the time. You know, we have compromised. We've really put ourselves out there to try to get this worked out, and we really feel that they gave us no choice in the matter.
And so, as I understand it, the heart of this disagreement comes down to the musician's pension plan. Gina, is that a fair description?
Yes, that is the main issue, but also. Their wage proposals are not in line with what we are, what we're looking for. We're looking to keep pace with the top orchestras in the country. Historically, the CSO has really set the standard in terms of our compensation, and we're looking to continue setting the standard. We've really fallen behind, especially orchestras on the West Coast, such as LA and San Francisco. They're quite a bit ahead of us now, and you know, in the last, especially 10 years, we've really seen our wages fall behind them. So we really need to keep up with them.
Yeah. And, you know, when we're talking about average wages, do we have a sense of percentages or how much wages have fallen behind in Chicago compared to, say, the West Coast?
Well, at this point, Cynthia, can you help me out with that as far as percentage?
Sure.
Or just dollar figures to give people a sense of what we're talking about here in terms of average wages?
Well, basically, we have not even seen cost of living wage increases in the last 7 years. So basically, you know, with San Francisco and LA getting at least 3% raises, 4%, and then they're getting housing allowances and such, their numbers have jumped way ahead of us.
Mm-hmm. And
so basically,
go ahead, Cynthia. Nope. Sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no. We're asking for, you know, cost of living adjustments that we haven't really received. And that's how we are falling further and further back for this upcoming contract. We really just want to kind of stop the slide that we've been seeing in our compensation package in relation to other orchestras that are making gains.
Hmm. And we did reach out to the Chicago Symphony Orchestra Association. That's the organization that manages the orchestra. And they pointed us to a press release from Monday. The president, Jeff Alexander, said in part, quote, "With the final offer on Sunday night, we have proposed a long-term agreement that would allow the parties to repair their working relationship, bring stability to the organization, support musicians in a transition to a new retirement benefit, and grow the annual base salary by 12%. Retaining a contract that remains at the top of our industry," end quote. Cynthia, what's your response to that?
Well, the kicker there is the part about the pension. So basically right now we have a defined benefit pension, which allows us incredible stability in our retirement. And they would like to take that away from us so that we burden the risk of the investments and the returns and are basically leave our retirement open to the market returns.
So more like a 401k, it sounds like, than
exactly
a pension?
Exactly like a 401k.
Okay.
Yes, exactly. So that to us is not a great package that they're offering us.
Gina, why is preserving the pension plan so important to you and your colleagues that you have decided to go out on strike?
Well, there are a few reasons. I mean, of course, the security that a defined benefit pension is for our members, it's huge. You know, to know what you're going to be getting when you retire is so important. As far as, comparison with other orchestras, for us to stay at the top, we need to retain our defined benefit pension. You know, San Francisco and the Boston Symphony have defined benefit pension plans that are in really great condition because they've been looked after properly. And that's where we want to get to with the CSO's pension plan.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Cynthia.
Oh, another reason for keeping our defined benefit plan is, you know, we got a great letter from the Boston Symphony this morning, and they point out that, you know, the plan allows for natural attrition and turnover of players who are not going to be forced to work past the point where they can contribute fully at the high level that, you know, we expect ourselves to perform at. And that is like a stress that, you know, we as musicians go through every day to make sure that we can perform at the highest possible level. And to think that, you know, if your 401k is not returning so well, you kind of try to hang on so that you can keep adding to it is just not great for any musician.
Mm-hmm. Gina, can I ask you about, to Cynthia's point about performances, we heard a little bit of a performance that you all did at the Chicago Temple last week. You have a kind of a unique platform here. Unlike other striking workers, you guys are playing free concerts around Chicago as the strike is happening. When did you all decide to do that?
Well, when the strike started, you know, we got overwhelming support from so many of our patrons and people in the community. And these concerts are really a thank you to them. You know, it's not their fault that we're out on strike. We take very seriously our role in providing great music and to them. And so this is really just a thank you to them.
I think it's probably fair to say most listeners aren't clued into the compensation structure of classical musicians. What do you want people who are listening to know about this strike, Gina?
The Chicago Symphony Orchestra has been a cultural treasure of the world for over 100 years, 125, 126 years, I think. And, you know, to diminish that, that place in history by, you know, cutting and slashing our pension, our wages, not respecting the tradition that we have, upheld artistically for so long, I think is really a shame. And I hope that, our management and board will really take that into very serious consideration moving forward, because we want to end the strike, but we cannot do so without maintaining that stature.
That's Gina DiBello. She's a violinist. I want to thank Cynthia Yeh for also being with us, the principal percussionist for the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, both of the members of CSO's negotiating team, as we've been talking about their ongoing strike. Cynthia, Gina, thank you for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
You.
Every spring, billions of birds migrate across the U.S., and many of them wind up passing through Illinois. We expect this migration, of course, every year. Birds have evolved to be able to migrate even at night, but it turns out that our cities, and especially the lights in them, play a big role in disrupting this migration. It actually leads to millions of bird collision deaths a year, and a recent study found that Chicago is actually the most dangerous city for migratory birds in both the fall and spring. Kyle Horton is the lead author of the study. He's a postdoctoral fellow at Cornell's Lab of Ornithology, and he's on the line from there now. Hi, Kyle. Welcome to the 21st.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the light pollution, I wonder what kind of birds and just how many are migrating through Illinois, including Chicago, in the spring and fall?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, most birds that pass through the area are primarily migrating at night under the cover of darkness. So in North America in general, about 70% of bird species are considered migratory, and then of those, 80% migrate at night. So the birds passing through the Illinois area may range up to 250, 300 species of birds passing through spring and fall.
And with that in mind, what makes Chicago uniquely dangerous then for these birds as we're thinking about their night migrations?
Yeah, so Chicago, when we looked at these rankings across the United States, we cataloged the top 125 largest cities, and we were looking at the sort of exposure of light pollution to these migratory birds. So it's a combination of the size of the city, how bright the city is, and then just how many migratory birds pass over that area. And Chicago is sort of uniquely positioned in that it's a very large city, it's quite bright, but also sits in a primary migratory corridor. So the central flyway of the United States sort of elevates Chicago to the top of our list for spring and for fall.
And so what actually happens, because you mentioned that the birds have evolved to know how to migrate in the dark. So how does the light throw them off?
Yeah, so these birds have evolved for hundreds of thousands of years to migrate under the cover of darkness. And they have many different sensory systems that allow them to do that, looking at the movement of stars through the night, or polarized light, or topographic features, a magnetic compass even. And only in the last 100 or so years has the landscape changed from being sort of completely dark to strongly illuminated from urban centers. And it seems like the light interacts with these sensory systems, and it seems to disorient and distract them along their migratory routes. So birds will become attracted to the lights. They'll circle and call incessantly through the night around these light sources. And sometimes it's not until the lights are turned off that they're able to escape the glow of a prominent light source.
Kyle, we just have about a minute left, but I want to just ask you one last question. We've talked on the show before about light pollution, but through the lens of astronomy. But in the same way, when we're thinking about migratory birds, are there design solutions you hope that city planners and architects can think about to resolve this issue?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think it's the encouraging aspect of this research. I think there are multiple lines that things can be done, whether it's at the development of construction, so planning for implementing safe glass that the birds can view, they're not as reflective, to turning lights off when the birds are on the move. So we have guidelines for when the birds should be moving through. So peak migration in Chicago is coming upon us. The window of peak migration for that area is around April 14th to May 20th. So you can, invoke some action there during that period, but also we have a forecasting system at birdcast.info to look at when the birds will be on the move each night, spring and fall.
All right. Well, thanks for that. We will tweet out the Kyle's study that he worked on, a distinction we obviously do not want in Illinois, being the most dangerous in the country for migrating birds. Kyle Horton is a postdoctoral fellow at Cornell's Lab of Ornithology. Kyle, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be speaking with Senator Tammy Duckworth, and we want to know if you have questions for her. You can text us. Save this number in your phone. You can always text us at this. It's 217-394-5765. That's 217-394-5765. Please include your first name and hometown. If you've got questions for the senator, we'll try to ask them for her. She's going to be on the air tomorrow. Our website, 21stshow.org, is a great resource for you if you'd like to find out how to follow us on social media, where to find past shows, to contact us. Just head to 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Bobby McSwine is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.